Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. As usual, we've got an amazing guest on today's show. She is actually one of our favorite guests. Don't tell the other guests we said that. Her name is Sisonke Msimang. She is the author of Always Another Country, a memoir of exile and home, shortlisted for the Alan Paton Award in 2018. Her work focuses on race, gender, and democracy. She's written for a range of international publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, Newsweek, and Al Jazeera. Now that I've read the blurb, or some of it, it gives me great joy to introduce to the latest episode of the Cheeky Natives, Sisonke Msimang and her latest book, The Resurrection of Winnie Mandela, which charts the rise and fall and rise of a woman who battled the apartheid regime with uncommon ferocity. Sisonke Msimang argues that Winnie Mandela's involvement in violence was a function of her political views rather than a descent into madness, that she was a warrior, not a witch, and that like many men involved in revolution, she fought fire with fire. With a blurb like that, can we do justice to our guest?
Welcome, Sisonke Msimang.
Yes, Alan Paton.
Welcome home.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I am very good, and I'm very excited because I've talked about this book outside South Africa, but there's nothing like talking about it at home, particularly because I wrote it for South Africans. Mm. So, you know, the other thing was extra. I was like, oh, okay. But this was really my objective.
Mm. So, I mean, we want to give people a taste of what this magic is. So can you please read for us?
Sure. So I'll read from the chapter called Johannesburg. And it starts with a quote from the queen of literary bayness, Toni Morrison. How soon country people forget. When they fall in love with a city, it is forever, and it is like forever, as though there never was a time when they didn't love it. The minute they arrive at the train station or get off the ferry and glimpse the wide streets and the wasteful lamps lighting them, they know they are born for it. There, in a city, they are not so much new as themselves. They're stronger, riskier selves.
Sure.
You are 17. The city is large and busy and it stinks, but the women smell beautiful. They are perfumed and powdered and a little bit blurry from the beer they sometimes drink. The women you meet here in Johannesburg are all learning to be something new. The city seeps into you and makes you a new kind of woman too. You are innocent and young. You call yourself a country bumpkin, but you are not. The education you have had and the leadership skills and your father's lessons and your mother's death, the way you are in the world, all of this already makes you worldly. You fit here. You simply become more of who you have always been.
Sure. Whew. All right.
I mean, okay.
We can end the podcast here. I think everybody's encouraged to go get Sisonke's book. It's available at all your favorite bookstores. Sure. So we read the Resurrection of Winnie Mandela sometime last year. We actually had
an authorless book.
And it was amazing. We had such a great time.
I can't believe it. I mean, you guys are... Talk about innovation and disruption and... taking books seriously and thinking outside the box. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on the podcast. I genuinely talk about you guys all the time as an example of all those things.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I mean, to start with the big question, right? The title of the book is The Resurrection of Winnie Mandela.
Mm.
And you talk about it being a biography of survival. Mm. Why was it important for you to title it The Resurrection of Winnie Mandela?
And I mean, as a lead up to that, you, in your introduction, which is powerful, you talk about how the world was not prepared for Winnie Mandela's death in the way that it was prepared for Nelson Mandela's passing.
That's right.
And why, and I mean, just as an add-on to what Atlokonole said, why did you think that was such an important fact to add in the introduction? I mean, you lead with this fact.
Yeah. So in many ways, your questions are great because they dovetail so nicely. I mean, what you've just said really responds to the question. So because the world was not ready and we had not anticipated that she would go, for many reasons, mm-hmm. when she passed away, I think many of us wanted her to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So with Madiba, there had been such a long preparation, and the country was ready because it was such a long illness, and he was so aged, right? And so there had been a real sense that the state was ready, the world was ready, there had been camera crews, you know, I'll remember all of that drama back and forth and so on and so forth. So there was really a readiness. And part of the readiness, of course, functions as a metaphor for the care and deliberation with which Nelson Mandela's life was treated by this country. And some of the unreadiness when it comes to Mamwini was the lack of care, the lack of thoughtfulness with which she was treated by many in our country, including our state. And you saw that in the week following, that they were completely caught off guard, not just by her passing away, but they were also caught off guard by the response to her passing away. The mass outpouring of love and affection and tribute really took them by surprise. And if they had anticipated that, they would have been more ready. So this is really the genesis of the book. You know, watching this all happen raised many questions for me about the differential way that women are treated as heroes of the nation versus men as heroes of the nation, always in diminished status, almost always as afterthoughts, almost always as an invisible shadow to the great man. So I wanted to write into that, into those questions.
And you say, right on from the bat, you say, I won't pretend otherwise. I'm interested in redeeming Winnie. So what's interesting for me is this idea of resurrection, so wanting her to come alive. But more important, there's a redemption.
That's right.
Why do you think that she needed to be redeemed?
That's right.
And also at the time of her death, like you're saying, a lot of people were surprised by the outpouring of love because it had almost become quite fashionable to speak quite derisively of Mamwini, to speak in quite negative terms. And I mean, that's also just in contrast to how Nelson Mandela was this shining hero, and she was almost the antithesis of that. Right?
That's right.
And then during the week, or just the weeks that followed her passing, there was almost this coming together of black feminists.
That's right.
And I wonder if in any way the work of those black feminists and that coming together also then influenced your desire to write the book in the way that you did.
Absolutely. It definitely did. I think we all saw a moment of rupture in the narrative of who she was. And we took a hold of that rupture. When there's an opening like that, when a fabric is torn, you can either tear it further or you can try to patch it up. And I think what we decided to do was tear it completely off the main fabric of the nation and say, this is ours. We are going to claim this piece of the nation, and we shall name this piece of the nation Winnie. And we will talk about what this piece of the nation meant to us. And so the fact that that happened amongst us severally really gave me strength. It gave me the sort of intellectual backing, and it made me realize that there was more to this than simply a short article. So yes, I definitely, again, I was very conscious that I was writing into a particular moment. And that moment was one filled with really interesting black feminist voices that were coming at issues from different ways, depending on our particularities, but with the same political agenda, which was to open out a conversation about the double standards, the hypocrisy, etc.
And I suppose the redemption comes from that, right? There was this whole saga, effectively, like, you know, she was called murderess.
Yeah.
There were all these bad words that were used.
She was called a mugger of the nation.
A mugger, exactly. And the redemption came from black feminists and even young feminists, young people of South Africa saying, nope, this is not the mother of the nation that you will treat like this.
That's right. And so part of what's happening in a moment like that is it's also a time to step back and reflect on progress. So that kind of response is not possible without progress having already been made around a whole set of political and cultural markers. So I think had this moment happened 5 or 10 years ago, it might have been a different response. our voices might have been weaker, we might not have had as cogent a set of arguments as those who are visibly talking, but also the mass support from young women on the ground. For me, that was very interesting because it spoke to how much the elite had misjudged how much support she had.
So you wrote this book in a very interesting way for a number of reasons. The book is interesting, firstly, because like Tlhokonolo said, you called it a biography of survival. So if you were, for example, looking for an in-depth biography on Umam Winnie, this book was not
this
it.
This is not it.
But also the fact that Mama Winnie has written about her own life.
Yes, there are many exists,
there is
yeah.
a lot of work. So
there's
I think
a lot of biographical data.
But I also, her. I mean, I also just in response to that, I don't necessarily always believe that. I think we get to a point where people ask, how many more books will we write about Winnie? And then you see that library of books that have been written by Abraham Lincoln. So I also
exactly.
think there's always going to be room and space for us to delve a little bit deeper
Absolutely.
Into the people we'd admire. But you also then wrote this book in the second person writing narrative, which is very interesting. It's not a device that you see commonly, right?
And particularly for a biographical type of
That's
work.
Right.
So you wrote to her,
That's
but
right.
also wrote about
her.
So we're
right.
really interested in why you decided to write it in second person.
There's an intimacy involved in the second person that is not possible when you step back and do the objective biographer thing. And I didn't want to pretend that, one, because as you've just so eloquently stated, it's not really a biography. This is I specifically called it a biography of survival. And so her life provides us an opportunity to think about a whole set of questions. Mm-hmm. But to do justice to her life in an annotated, footnoted, in-depth way is a different project. And that's not the project that I was interested in. So I wrote it in the second person because I wanted an intimacy. I also wanted to be able to address her in a way that she had so seldom been addressed in the public domain. Mm-hmm. People spoke about her, they shouted at her, they insulted her, mm-hmm. but they rarely actually addressed her.
Mm.
And so I wanted to take that seriously.
Mm. And I really enjoyed that. I particularly also enjoyed the way you played with history. Because I think when we think about history, we think about it as factual. And not to say that it isn't factual, but there was a way in which you did it. You made it playful. Like, I wanted to be in Bizana, in the frontier, in the capital.
Yeah.
I wanted to be there. Because I'm like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. Why was that so important for you?
And also, just as a comment to that, I think part of why it's so important that we write and that we sort of take ownership of moments in history that feel very intimate to us is that it allows us some sort of agency over the ways in which those stories get told. I think part of the reason why this book was so important was because the narrative around Winnie for the longest time had been controlled by people who really had no intimate knowledge or intimate stake in how the politics of her life played out, you know, so
and didn't care about her
and was so unbothered as well. So we're okay with calling her the mugger of the nation.
That's
I mean,
right.
really?
Yeah.
Like, where is the depth?
That's right. So it's a very small book, but it's a very ambitious book.
Yes.
Because I wanted it to operate on multiple levels and in many registers. So the history is the one that you've just touched on, and that became apparent to me as I began to do the research. Because, as I say, I didn't want to do a straight biography. I wanted to use her life as a thread that tied together a lot of questions that we have about why South Africa is the way it is today. And if you want to understand why South Africa is the way it is today, you cannot simply look at the 50-year period of apartheid from 1948 to 1994. Mm. That doesn't work. You have to understand colonization, you have to understand settlement, you have to understand the idea of terra nullis, the notion that this land was empty, which is contradicted by so much archival evidence by white people themselves who love to take notes. And their notes contradict their story.
And
their notes, that's right, and their notes are their notes demonstrate that there were many, many black people living, settled. And because they continue to return to this founding myth, I thought that it's an important way to deal with that question as we deal with Mamwini, because she comes from a place where the Kafir wars were fought, where these tensions, where these lies were initially told. So again, this is part of why I'm always so interested in nonfiction, because it gives us so much to work with. And so the decision to look at Winnie Mandela's life, I never would have thought that it would then lead me down this path of understanding how important it is to talk about the broader history of this country. It also became apparent to me, as I talked to people and as I did the research, that we don't know our history beyond a very superficial level. And I'm always interested in writing in a way that opens out our history and our histories in more accessible language. And so I set myself a kind of literary challenge, which was to tell history, to talk about King Hintsa, to talk about that history of resistance in a story-like fashion, so that people might become interested and then go and seek out more history themselves.
Speaking of the multiple layers to black women, particularly black women that we admire, I thought it was very interesting that there was this contrast between her life as Winnie Mandela and as Winnie Madikizela Mandela, right? And the distinction that then exists between those two identities. Particularly because we've spoken about erasure before, and the ways in which almost having a powerful husband seems to erase the woman that they're married to of their own identities. So it seems like your life really began when you became Michelle Obama, for example, and that you had no preceding achievements, you had no preceding history. There was really no life prior to the entrance of this person in your life. And I wanted to know what you hoped to achieve with the contrast between her life as Winnie Mandela and as Winnie Madikizela Mandela.
And why also, I suppose, concomitant to that, you chose to, in the book, address her as Winnie Mandela and not Winnie Madikizela Mandela.
She fought very hard in her life, and that name became her. And so I wanted to honor that. And for those who tried to strip her of that royalty, in a sense, that and she, so I thought it's fine to give her that, that she will always be that person. And in the height of her power, and when she was most fierce and ferocious and publicly recognizable, that's who she was. And so in some ways, part of me wanted to keep that top of mind, but not in any way to erase, you know, the other parts of who she was. And in fact, this idea of it was very important to me when I told the love story between the two of them, to challenge this other myth that we often hear, which was that Madiba shaped her politics. You hear it all the time. And yet when you look at the archive, and when you read about her life, and when you think about what she was interested in debating, how intelligent she was, how as soon as she gets to Johannesburg, before she meets him, she surrounds herself with these powerful women who are involved in the trade union movement, who are learning as much as they can about workers' struggles and about people's struggles. They have reading circles. This has nothing to do with Nelson Mandela. And I wanted to be clear, because very often part of what patriarchy likes to do is to create this idea that women are chosen, that what we do is sit in a corner on the edge of the dance floor waiting for the men to come, and then we stand when this one chooses us. And Winnie Mandela chose him because he represented the political agenda that she believed in of her own accord. So they really are a meeting of political equals. I wanted that to be clear. I wanted to shift that narrative, because so often the story is told about how she was a country bumpkin and he found her, and then...
And I liked what you did. You speak about she saw him before he saw her. So she had already made that decision of this is the ideal that I want.
And then later, when you read Part of My Soul, she says, oh, Yeah, he doesn't even know. To this day, as I'm writing this, he has no idea that I saw him first. Mm. Right? So subversive. Mm. So that there's this undercurrent of subversion always with Mamwini. She's always fully aware of what's happening, and she's making a determination about how she's going to play a particular situation. Also remember that Madiba divorces his first wife because they're not a political match. Mm-hmm. So he's looking for an equal. Mm. And part of why it was important to set that ground is to say that these two built one another. Mm. That they deserved one another. And so that if you want to love Nelson Mandela and you want to hate Winnie Mandela, I'm trying to make it very hard for you to do that. Mm. Because these are people who chose one another and they were the same. Mm.
It's also, it feels like a reclamation of her identity, right? Because, I mean, we don't often hear about her early politics. So you don't often hear about what happened when she came to Joburg.
Or her intellectual vigor.
Yeah, people just assume that, you know, oh, she came here and met Nelson Mandela. Cool, great.
And that's it.
And, you know, and then became this wife to this person who's amazing. But not that there was a personal life that preceded that, you know. And I mean, it also just speaks to this idea of the dutiful wife,
exactly,
who stayed and waited for her husband. And that's often the story that I think gets played for a lot of women who are married to what have now become considered stalwarts of the struggle. Mm-hmm. That you were dutiful wives who stayed and waited meekly while your husbands were in prison and did all the work.
And that's, sorry to interrupt, but that's why I love. So for me, it's these little details. This is the thing about writing about someone's life. It's these small details that seem not to matter, but matter greatly.
Mm.
So a great illustration of that is when he's in prison. I don't remember now which trial it was that he was facing. He may have already been locked up on Robben Island. And the police come and they raid the house. And she's reading Trotsky. Mm-hmm. So that upends any idea that you might have that this is just some meek woman who doesn't know anything and is not interested in the political world of ideas. On her own, in her house, at 4 o'clock in the morning, she's reading Trotsky, right?
Mm.
This gives you a sense of the person that we're talking about.
Yeah. I think also in the earlier question about your decision to write about Winnie Mandela, also writing about Winnie Madikizela Mandela, there's an interesting thing that you do in the book where you write in certain instances about Winnie. Mm. And then in other instances, you write about Ma Winnie. Mm. And I wanted to know why that was important for you, because I read it and I got it. Yeah. But I think a lot of people may think that is an inconsistency in reference. Yeah. And I think it was intentional, but I don't know.
Yeah, it was intentional. One, just as a literary device, I think there's a monotony to reading the same name over and over again. So I think it's nice to mix it up. But also, it was part of establishing both an intimacy. There are moments when I want to address her by her first name because I want to speak to her as a woman.
Mm. Woman to woman.
Woman to woman, as equals. And then there are moments, and those are moments often of accountability.
Yes.
Or there are moments where I'm like, I get you. I understand this, right? And then there are moments when I want to speak to her as Mam Winnie because I want to respect her.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want the and I don't want the reader to ever lose sight of my subjectivity, that I am a black woman speaking to and writing for and about a black woman who has meant a lot to us historically. And so humbling myself is important. Mm-hmm. And so having Mam Winnie is a humbling.
Mm-hmm.
And often the biographer assumes a position of authority.
Yes.
And part of what feminism teaches us is that those kind of hierarchies are actually bullshit. And so to burst the hierarchies, then you play around with naming, and then you also choose to refer to someone in a way that shows them the respect that you would traditionally if she were in front of us.
The idea of accountability comes through in later parts of the book, and I think it also then leads to a very serious but very necessary conversation around forgiveness and the TRC. And I mean, it's
I think my favorite parts of the book is just when Sisanke goes to town and I'm like,
yeah, there she is. I think that the people on my WhatsApp who may not be that way inclined were feeling dragged. I was like, preach. I was like writing whole paragraphs. I'm like, Sisanke ain't ever lied. She never lied. But I think that the issue of accountability is a particularly interesting one for Mamwini, because a lot of what happened at the TRC and this notion of, you know, this kumbaya forgiveness that was a blanket forgiveness to some but not others, then didn't extend to her. But there's also the question of what it means for the victims of some of the things that led to that, you know. So when you think of Stompie's family, right, and their quest for answers, and how that just never came through, and how there was not even a sense of remorse, even if you may not have been directly involved. I mean, like you're saying, she was always a woman who knew what was happening.
That's right.
And to just completely plead like ignorance and to then just remove yourself from the equation.
Lolo Sono's family for me is the one where you're really, Lolo Sono's mother, in terms of accountability, she's the one who looks Mamwini in the eye and says, this is not okay. And in many ways, that's what the TRC process was supposed to do. Mm. It was supposed to force a really tough conversation with people who had been victimized and to be able to hold their perpetrators to account. That's the society we want. So it was very important to include that and to not shy away from that. It was also very important to step back and look at the TRC process in context, and to also talk about the way those questions weren't asked of many other people. So she was,
and the time, because you make this distinction to be there are certain people who just went there for one day, but her testimony spanned over nine days,
and it also felt very, very deliberate. It made you think of the standards to which we hold certain people in society.
It was very personal.
It was very, very personal.
So it's very personal because there's some legitimate reasons why it was personal. One of the legitimate reasons it's personal is because the expectations on her were so very high.
Yes.
She had done so much and had been such a beacon. And so that's a high place from which to fall. So I get that. It's also the case that she was a woman for whom acts of violence are always so much harder to stomach than men. It's also the case that the moment at which she begins to spin out of control is a moment when the entire African National Congress is spinning out of control and is moving towards a ferocious embrace of all sorts of vigilante violence as part of a campaign of ungovernability. But somehow we pull Winnie Mandela out of that and single her statements and her actions out. When we know townships were burning, we know that there was massive jackrolling, that there were so much necklacing, and that often the orders for those things to happen did come from people who were very senior in the movement. But for some reason, there's only one name that we can ever associate with those acts, when we know those acts were taking place all over the country, especially in KZN. So the specificity, the fact that we emerge from history with only one name carrying the burden for these acts, seemed to me something that we needed to focus on. I couldn't write this book without focusing on that, which is not a way to rationalize or absolve her, but it is a way to say we need to put this conversation into context.
I think it's so interesting that you're saying it's not a conversation to absolve her, because the other side of the coin of this reclamation of Mamwini's identity has also been almost a deification.
That's right.
Which is also, I mean, and you sort of allude to it in the book, why you're particularly concerned about this deification of Mamwini, not to take away from any of her amazing work, but you delve almost quite deeply into why you're concerned about us now making her this deity as a response to some of the criticisms about, some of them valid, some of them obviously just rooted in misogyny, of her identity. And I think if you could just speak a little bit about...
So what I want is fair treatment, right? That's what feminists want. That's what black
people
want.
That's all we want. That's all we want.
Feminists, fairness.
We don't want to be men.
That's
just
right.
Just kind of be treated equally.
So if we are saying that we want to build a society in which no act of violence is acceptable, and that the time where we draw the line in the sand is 1994, okay, if that's what we're saying, then all of those who perpetrated violence before 1994 ought to stand trial and judgment. And if only some are standing trial and judgment, then I have questions about the fairness of that process and how we then move forward. And it is important on some level to stand trial and judgment over people, which is precisely why I bring out of the shadows, because nobody ever talks about anyone except Stompy. And so I deliberately bring out of the shadows the 18 people who are associated in terms of disappearances and deaths who are associated with her. This is not a figure or statistic or metric that anyone talks about publicly. And I deliberately put it into the public domain as an act of accountability.
And you say it's in the archives, so it's not like it's secret. It's literally there for the public to see.
And part of why I say that is because I do want young people who are claiming her to know the full story. Let us claim our heroes knowing fully what they have done. In the same way that I want us to claim Nelson Mandela without deleting the fact that he claimed violence as a legitimate mode of struggle. At the moment, we claim him and we love him because of the love and the forgiveness. I want us to own our heroes in all of what they actually were. So that's what I'm trying to do with Winnie Mandela, in the same way that I tried to do it in my writing about Nelson Mandela, in the same way that I want to do it for all of us. So I don't want to make her a hero, nor do I want to make her a villain. Maybe that's the wrong statement. I want to make her a hero, but I want to make her a hero who you understand exactly what she has done.
I think that's powerful, because particularly for Black women, we don't often get written about in all those kind of hues and tones, you know. And I think that's also a large part of the reason why, in many ways, Winnie became almost maligned, you know. Is because we're not at a place where we haven't been given room to have an expression of identity that's quite full, so that you can be an icon, you can be great, you can be powerful, you can be all of these amazing things, but also participate in acts that are questionable and in acts of violence. And that necessarily doesn't demean or take away from your legacy, but it's also an accurate part of who you are. And that we can't feel slighted by the fact that we need to talk about Lolo Sun, right? And the fact that even people who love Mamwini feel some kind of way about having to have a discussion about violence and Lolo Sun makes you think of the ways in which we really characterize Black women in this country, and the ways in which we think about the fullness of Black women. Because those are the same people who turn around and say, yes, Nelson Mandela may have some point advocated for violence, but it was in response to the time, and, right?
But what's really interesting for me is returning to Alice Walker's essay in 1996 when she writes about the trial of Winnie Mandela. In the essay she writes, when she speaks about necklacing in particular, she says, she has not refuted the statement but claims it has taken out of context. It is interesting to note that others in the anti-apartheid movement, in moments of anger and grief, have, in their powerlessness, tossed out words of violence. Leah Tutu, for instance, the wife of Bishop Desmond Tutu, showed no compunction in stating to a television interviewer from South Africa Now, who inquired about her, the abuse and detention of police of small children and the arrest of her son, that she was so angry that if she had possessed a hand grenade, she would have thrown it, she felt sure, blowing the police to bits. But we don't elevate that story as in Leah may have been responsible for some of the burning that was happening. And Alice speaks about this idea of how the white supremacist government was targeting Mama Winnie particularly. So when we uplift the stories of Stompy, for instance, of Lolo, we uplift them not to talk about accountability, we uplift them to vilify her. So we're saying that this is this murderous woman.
It's a different intention.
Instead of saying, actually, Mama, which is what you seek to do and speak and bring to the discussion, that actually, I want to hold her accountable.
That's right.
And I want to say, you know, Mama, sometimes, you know, when the mother was looking you in the eye.
It happened, and you know it happened, and you owe her that sorrow.
And you were, it was just a reaction that was so out of touch with what we had come to expect from the mother of the nation, you know, that like, she was almost blasé and unapologetic. And I mean, we praise that unapologetic, you know what I mean? So when I was just doing research for the podcast, there in so many articles, interestingly, a lot of them written by men, talk about, no shade to them, or maybe a little bit, talk about how she always had her right hand in the fist, her right fist in the air, and that's almost like the enduring picture of Mamwini. But it's like, no one ever wants to talk about her time in prison, which is something that you go into.
Or Brandford.
And, I mean, you delve quite deeply into Brandford, you know, which you don't often hear about the town of Brandford and those years.
I went there. I traveled there.
And how was it?
It was really interesting. It was very hard to be in that house. Like, I walked around the rooms, and it was so small, and it was so damp. And, you know, she was such a larger-than-life character, and that idea of her being in that little place, it just made me respect what she had gone through even more. It was also interesting because as I wrote, you're writing in a way that's building up to this moment in which she's going to do things that you don't like. And so it was really important for me to not prejudge that moment and to write with innocence her life. Until until the moment when it's important to hold her accountable, that's when we hold her accountable. But not before. Don't write about her in a spoiled way before we get to that. And I think what people did was they looked back on her life with that lens.
Yes.
Instead of giving her that what she deserved.
What I really also enjoyed about the resurrection of Winnie Mandela was when you speak about forgiveness, you speak about forgiveness as it's afforded to or not afforded to Mama. But you also speak about forgiveness in the South African polity. You're like, let's have this conversation about forgiveness. And let's have this conversation about what it really means to forgive. And why was it important for you to use that as a moment to be like, South Africans, we haven't spoken openly about this forgiveness.
Especially because we seem to just oscillate in public debate. We're either kumbaya, kumbaya, we all love each other, South Africa for everyone. Or we're very angry and we're very dismissive of the TRC process, which, flawed as it was, had tried to do something which was quite monumental at the time for what it was doing.
And anywhere you go in the world, people will be like, at least you had the TRC.
That's right.
Of course, there was some kind of acknowledgement, as flawed and as problematic as it was, that the states in which we're in was abnormal. So, I mean, you've quite likely talking and saying there's a commentary on forgiveness, but I think for me, just the addendum to the question would be, what would you think that the ideal forgiveness then would have looked like as it applies to people who potentially have a contested legacy, like Kumamwini?
So it's been, the further we get away from this, our moment of independence, as it were, the further we get away from 1994, the more apparent it is to me that our story of reconciliation centered whiteness. And that's for understandable reasons. But what it means is that today we don't have to continue to insist on that narrative. And we also are able to think about what its implications are. And Mamwini is a classic example of what the implications are of centering whiteness in the forgiveness narrative. Because all of our energy and effort and tears and emotions are centered on saying it's okay to white people. And then what do we do with black people who did things that were wrong? We have no mechanism for that. And yet that was very much of part of what happened, right? Because a racist system implicates black people who are used again. You know, this is Jacob Zamini's work. You know, so there's a whole range of questions that black people must answer between themselves. And so once again, she's a vehicle to ask a larger question about what does national unity look like? And instead of national unity, South Africans talk about reconciliation. And reconciliation is black-white. National unity is a bigger question.
And you also use the word nation building. So you say that her resurrection is perhaps this unended you know, nation building.
It's an, project,
it's an opportunity for white people to reflect on what, how much they wanted to be forgiven and never themselves were able to forgive someone who did nothing against them.
Mm.
So the victims of Mamwini are all black children, right?
Mm.
And the hatred that white people have towards Mamwini makes no sense in that context.
Mm.
And their refusal to forgive her is a bigger question that I have.
Mm.
And it's the same community that expects us to forgive them.
Mm.
So this is the question that I think we have not yet reckoned with. And this is why this book
is
so important.
Right? That's what I want. And so my introduction and my conclusion do a lot of heavy lifting.
Yes, they
book.
Do. They do.
And that's probably my biggest critique of myself, because I wanted to work through a lot. And as I said, it's a small but ambitious book.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the core of the question that looking at the life of Winnie Mandela forces us to ask as a country.
There's something you do that's very interesting in your book, which we've also found to be something that Panache does in her latest book called These Bones Will Rise Again. So you speak about a frozen image. And Panache speaks about this frozen image of Umbuye Nahande in Zimbabwe. And I was like, these books are perfect companions to each other.
Great. And I haven't even read it, so
so let's have a conversation.
What's interesting is what she says. She says, to reimagine Mbuya Lillian's lost portrait is to begin to conjure up the galleries of portraits of African women erased from history through forced removal, migrant labor, rape by bus and fellow comrades, the exclusion of post-independence land ownership, domestic abuse, the treacherous route of cross-border trading, HIV/AIDS. To imagine these portraits of women erased from the arsenal of official history is to confront our compulsion to erase and mitigate the image in the story of our making.
Mm.
To reimagine the portraits of women such as Mbuye Nahande who have been enlarged and frozen is to confront our compulsion to reframe and distort their image in the story of our making. To imagine these women, both named and unnamed, is to face the historical presence of both psychological and sociological manifestation of cumulative and intergenerational trauma and triumph that have brought us, our nation, here. And she writes about this in the Zimbabwean context, but also in the South African context, because being a Zimbabwean South African.
Yeah.
And I thought it was so powerful that you also speak about this frozen image of there is this ideality that we have about Umamawini, and we've frozen her there.
That's right.
And your book tries to disrupt that, right? To be like, actually,
she was moving, shifting, constantly. And that's why I at the end talk about, you know, when she died, she was an old woman. Like she wasn't what you wanted her to be. She was who she became.
And maybe that's also in part why people were so unprepared for her passing, was because they hadn't made room for
the possibility that she would die.
But also just the possibility that perhaps she was just a living human being who moved and navigated different points in her life.
That's right.
And I mean, for people who really admire her and for people who completely vilify her, both of those things rest almost on just like a freezing. Of
that's
her
such
in
a great
time.
Observation, Amanisha. Yeah. That's a great observation. That freezing is the condition upon which you can adore her or hate her.
Yeah.
And that if you see her as a woman in full, then it opens up all kinds of other possibilities for understanding her, for learning from her, whether that learning is positive or negative.
And I think it's a great feminist work thinking about even this, These Bones Will Rise Again and The Resurrection, about the idea of black women seem to be frozen in time.
Yes.
And even the freezing doesn't have to do with a particular moment, but it has to do like a caricature.
That's right.
Black women have strength.
That's right.
Black women can endure pain. And I think your book disrupts that. To be like, yeah, sure, she was strong, because strong people are the only people who can make survive this apartheid
That's
system.
Right.
Who can survive apartheid prison.
Yeah.
But she was also other things.
All these other
she was
things.
Tender.
That's right.
She was loving.
That's
she
right.
missed her husband greatly.
So much. I mean, for me, their love was really, it was very important to me to talk about that. you know, in part because they have been pitted against one another as these people who we're either Team Nelson or Team Winnie, you know, in a ridiculous fashion, but also because it is that place where they just adored one another. Yeah, it was very special and beautiful, and it allows us to see them as soft and as tender and not just our fist in the air.
Also, I mean, to then speak about her family, we don't often think about the relationships between people we consider struggle icons and their children and what that looks like, what it looks like to have a mother and a father that people almost claim public ownership of.
But also to be a single parent. I think that,
we've
just
years.
Erased that. We don't remember that here is a woman who was living in Soweto raising her daughters.
And I mean, the other book written by another author who has to come on the podcast if he wants his name to be mentioned. then almost explores this idea of, you know, the dutiful wife who then is sitting at home and waiting. But I think the reality of that is very, very different. And I don't think that we often delve into that. What the reality looks like of having to raise children while navigating police raids, while navigating a husband who is in prison. So you are effectively...
And you're banned and you're not allowed to work.
But you also, your life is not stagnant. And I think sometimes with this romanticization of the struggle and what it meant for the people involved in the struggle, we almost romanticize certain things. And I mean, there's really nothing romantic about the states in which she was living in. It was abnormal. And what would it have looked like had she been in prison for 27 years? Would there also then have been an expectation that she waits dutifully?
With legs crossed. I also think that this is part of why so many women love her. Mm. And this is why so many Black South Africans love her, because she is every woman.
Yes.
Because everybody knows what it's like to have your husband far away. And so for Madiba, it's Robben Island, but for so many Black men, it was the mines.
Yes.
Everybody knows what it feels like to be a single mother.
Yes.
Everybody also knows what it's like to have to send your children away, as Mam Winnie had to do, to send those kids to Swaziland because we were being harassed so much. Mm. So many Black women know what it means to have to visit your children, not live with them. So it's a life of constant fragmentation and separation, which is precisely the premise of apartheid, that we will fragment and break up Black families. And she,
that's the very project.
That's the project. And she embodies that project, and everyone understands what it feels like to be her. But she speaks back. She says no. She fights the police. So she is our best selves. This is why Winnie Mandela, no matter what you want to say about her, how much propaganda and spies and how much you want to say, she did this and she mugged and she did, it doesn't matter, because that is indelibly what for 27 years people remember about her. That she stood up when they couldn't. And she endured what they
endured. And it also cuts across class. I mean, the issues of class are coming to the fore, particularly for Black people, because we're starting to ask ourselves what Black unity looks like. And we often think of migrant labor and as sort of things that are a little bit distant from you, right? People don't make the connection between their migrant labor and I guess just the ordinary lived experience of even the most wealthy Black South Africans, right? And I mean, here was Winnie really just being an example, like you're saying, of that, you know. So then you start to think of what that means for your domestic worker who also visits her children.
That's
and
right.
What that means in the greater scheme of things to have children who may not have the resources to, for example, be sent to some of the best schools in Swaziland. Right? So what is the lived reality then? And also the idea that the apartheid project then didn't end in 94, if we're dealing with those kind of remnants of that project. And Mam Winnie really asks us to...
She forces all of those conversations, many layers, even things that I couldn't, you know, even get to, right? Absolutely. This is why she is you know, she presents herself as this figure who, she's like a palette.
Yes.
And you choose which colors you're going to focus on, but they're all there.
And she's vulnerable. She's human. She's vulnerable in ways that we're not accustomed to seeing black women be vulnerable, right?
This is part of, when you talked about family, this is also part of why I really wanted to focus on the relationship she had with her father.
Yes.
You know, again, because we think about the struggle heroes, but we don't think about them.
Coming from a family.
From someone. They just descend.
No, that's true. That's true. There is an essay you wrote short, you know, in the scurry.
Yeah.
In the scurry.
Yeah.
Mm. And you say, Africa is what I decide it will be. Mm. My Africa is full of queers and women. It is crowded with misfits and big mouths, and all the people in my Africa are irregular. My Africa is full of everything the big men fear. And I think, in a way, this is it.
Yes.
This is the resurrection of Winnie. It's like, it is full of queers and full of women, right? And in particular, women who were belligerent, you know.
And who trouble.
Yeah.
We also have to acknowledge Mamuni's homophobia. We also have to accept that part of what begins this stompy chapter is this whisper that's put into her ear that that Bishop Paul Verrain is a homosexual, mm-hmm. and that he's fiddling with the kids.
Mm.
You know, it's a classic trope that we use to other queer people, right?
Yeah.
And so we also have to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
It's a part I didn't give enough space.
Yeah.
And I had to make all these choices. It's actually probably the one thing that I regret that I just didn't explore.
Yeah.
But
I think I agree, like I would have wanted more of that, right?
Yes.
But I think in some ways you do leave us open with Mamuni was not perfect.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Oh, there's no question about that.
There is no good or bad.
Yeah.
There is complex.
Yes.
There is big.
Yeah.
And let us read this legacy in this complexity.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because if we say no to Mamuni's legacy, then we should say no to Nelson Mandela's legacy.
Mm. Absolutely.
You know, and if we say no to Mamuni, then there are many other people that we have to reconsider and what are these choices that I've made,
right?
So I think in a way, for me, what the resurrection does is for us to sit back and, you know, as your famous essay floating around, all our faves are problematic, is to look at that and interrogate for yourself whether you are going to continue defending someone but having the full information, or whether you're going to be like, you know what, this is not the hill that I'm willing to die
on.
So I'm going to let this one go.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, I'm glad you reminded me of that essay, because in fact, that is, it definitely embodies a strain of my thinking that it's part of what I'm always trying to do anyway. No matter the essay or the book that I'm writing, I'm always trying to problematize things that seem straightforward.
Mm.
Because life is too unstraightforward for that.
I don't want to give this conversation space, but I feel that we just need to, like, just 2 minutes. So there's this other book that came out around the same time that your book came out. And obviously this other book is a little problematic, but I wanted to know what your thoughts were, because I think the book is also sort of exists in the scurry that was happening around Mama's Winnie.
Yeah.
There was these two opposites.
Yeah.
Either people were vilifying her or people were praising her.
Mm.
And it exists in that. What are your thoughts around this other book?
I haven't read it.
Mm.
When you are trying to write something, you have to just write it and not engage with other things on the subject after a certain while, because otherwise we'll just be all over the place. And the two books, in fact, it came out right after. And so I have to be honest, I haven't read it. I had a really fascinating interaction with the author after, which is probably another conversation for another day. But I will say that they're seeking to do different things. So they occupy different terrain, and they're a great example. Both books are excellent example of how much space there is to discuss so many things about Mamuni.
Mm.
That book took a trajectory that I would never personally take, because it seeks to dig into and understand further the particular crimes and in relation to Dr. Ashfat.
Mm.
This is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise of my book, because it's not a biography and does not pretend to be some investigative journalism, the premise of my book is about understanding the meaning of her. So what I fear will happen is that, you know, people will dig and dig and new information will come to light and this will come and this will come, and people will use that as an excuse to further vilify or to further undermine her, or to say, you see, you were wrong and she never did these things. And for me, that is completely inconsequential. The actual acts are completely inconsequential because we've dealt with that. And so my argument holds, regardless of what new evidence or old evidence is unearthed, I'm talking about her meaning and the meaning of this conversation about reconciliation, the centering of whiteness, and the larger project of building national unity. That doesn't change. And so I hope as new stuff comes up, people don't just go, oh, well, Sasaki was defending her. Well, actually, my defense stands, just as my troubling of certain waters stands, regardless. It's independent of
that. But thank you so much for this fantastic conversation. I think Alma and I always enjoy talking to you.
Always.
I think one of the things is because you're so thoughtful. I feel that even when I read your book, I see the decisions that you made and where they're coming from. Like, you spent a lot of time thinking about, okay, is this going to go in? Is this not going to go in? And I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that about your writing, that you're thoughtful.
And there's a great respect for the audience. So even in reading your book, there were things that I didn't know that I went back to do research on. I mean, just part, like, as an indictment maybe of the history that we get taught, there wasn't much knowledge that I'd had, for example, about the Kaffa Wars. So,
and I'm so glad to hear
reading that. I went back and I was like, this is very interesting. Let me read about King and so let me go and find out, right? And I mean, part of that is also just taking agency for ourselves, right? We can continue to lament the fact that we haven't been taught enough of our history, or we can use moments like these as teachable moments and then go and just do the research and do the work that's necessary. I mean, now you realize that there were other feminist women who informed Winnie's politics long before she had encountered Nelson Mandela. And what does that look like for your framing of what you think the struggle may have been, right? That's and then how do we then begin the work of undoing the erasure of all of these women who have done enormous work? I mean, God, the fact that there are not enough books on, like, Sophia Brandt, for example, is an indictment. So you read the book, and I'm really hoping that there are going to be a whole bunch of young black feminists who read this kind of work and are then inspired to do the work of resurrecting some of our other some of our other struggles, stalwarts, in ways that really honor their legacies in the full completeness. I don't think that anyone except, and I said this even at the launch, I don't think that anyone except a black feminist woman could have written this book.
Oh, thank you.
Just because of the way in which the gaze which was used to write this book and the lens that was used to write it was so important, because it gave room for the fullness of who she was. So we can hold you in love, but we can hold you in accountability.
That's right.
And that's not something that often gets, that's not a grace that's often extended to black women. We are either holding you in love, then you're
this pedestal, and the minute you fall.
Then that's it. You are now erased. I mean, there were points in Mamuni's life where it seemed like she had never, ever been associated with the ANC.
That's right.
You know, she was treated almost like a leper.
A pariah.
Yeah.
There is something that Alice Walker says in an essay, which you also, in not so many ways, but in so many ways, say, when you speak about the divorcing, the ending of the marriage, you don't focus on what other people like to focus on, you know, the irreconcilable differences.
Yeah.
But you speak about the fact that Mama Winnie and Nelson were both committed to the cause. They were both committed to politics.
That's right.
And Mama Winnie was committed to the cause.
Mm.
And in some ways, these two courses do not align.
That's right.
And Alice Walker says in her essay, she says that they suspected correctly, I believe, that she's far more radical than her husband and has a longer and fuller memory of wrongs.
That's right. And she keeps track.
Yeah. And that's what you were saying. You were like, she's like, we know what these people have done to
us. She's like, hold up now.
Hold a minute. And they represent two really valid and important streams of thinking within the struggle. And again, what happens with history is we subsume everything into one thing. And we look back with this nostalgic, wonderful gaze that everything was peaceful and everyone all got along and there weren't real tensions. So again, their intellectual differences as well as the similarities make for part of why they loved one another so much, part of why their relationship was so passionate, but also why they were able to part, understanding that this was both political and personal.
Yeah.
And also this room, and I feel like you touch on that, that this romanticization of history then robs us of the ability to call people to account.
That's right.
Whether it is Mam Winnie
or
being called to account for the deaths of these 18 young people that we have just never really reached a full, you know, disclosure on, or the ways in which Nelson Mandela acquiesced certain people and what that means for the Rainbow Nation,
you know.
And I think that is really the danger, and we saw it with in those few weeks after Mamuni had died, how people were either just, you know, completely deifying her or were vilifying her without really being honest to the history of things, because those things did happen in the same way that she was a strong, powerful woman who did amazing things.
And saved many lives, let's be clear.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? If we want to start counting bodies,
you
know, this is a point I make, that the bodies that that the mining houses that we can add up if we wanted to stack bodies, I think that would be a very different accounting, but we don't talk in those terms.
Or members of the killer squads who were brying while incinerating people's bodies and have still not accounted for so many missing people. Like, there are some people in this country who don't have closure.
That's right.
And the danger with this romanticization of the Rainbow Nation project is that it doesn't ask hard questions of those people, and this is why people can have the audacity to tell us that colonization was good.
But also, it doesn't ask... So again, I have no problem if we're not going to ask hard questions because we decide collectively we want to move on. But then don't ask hard questions of Mam Winnie.
Let's all move
just
on.
Choose one or the other. Or the other. But don't then have a double standard. This is my fundamental
problem.
I'm not questioning your Rainbow Nation. I'm like, if we want to go rainbow, let's do full rainbow, but then let's do it.
Yeah.
And don't have a different set of rules when it comes to women who are troublesome.
Yes. Because that not doing it for me, I think, has led to so much of the questions that exist and that continue to exist, and why we're still having issues with penny sparrows, right? And people seem shocked. They're like, oh my God, really? Like, people do that? But it's also because you've been allowed room to just divorce yourselves from...
Kolini. Like, we can name all the... The dirt of the South Africa.
Oh, that's my next project.
So this is the favorite part of the podcast.
Yes. We're gonna give you land.
I'm glad I get some.
So we want to be in keeping with the work that you've been doing around Mama Winnie. We want to take you to her home province, you know,
because
so that you can commune with the spirits in that province, you know, so that you can get that signal clearly, you know.
We didn't even talk about Julius Malema.
So
I hope you write a book.
So we want you to be able to look into the vast earthing, you know?
Of the ocean.
Of the ocean.
As you continue your work, because there's more work to be done, right?
So we want to give you land in Ganubi.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
You deserve land in Ganubi.
Thank you.
Yes.
Please use one.
And we know, we have no doubt, that the next project you're going to do is going to take us deeper and deeper into this nation building project that we're trying to do. So thank you, Sisonke, for writing The Resurrection of Winnie. But also thank you for always availing yourself to speak to us as the Cheeky Natives.
My absolute pleasure. You guys are always just so thoughtful yourselves, and you do your research. So thank you.
Yay.
Until next time. Bye.
Bye.